Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. As always, you know I love it when you come to my house and you bring the love by doing that download thing. It makes me feel all yummy inside. And certainly love it when you want to sit in and kind of participate in the conversation by listening. That's what we do here. But I'm really excited about who's dropped by the podcast for a conversation today. I've known Jennifer for a long time, certainly followed her career professionally and her work in journalism. She has been an incredible, advocate for good, smart journalism, but more recently, a very strong proponent of democracy and democratic principles. And I think a lot of people out there respect that, if nothing else. She writes reported opinion for the Washington Post. She covers politics and policy, foreign and domestic, and provides insight into the conservative movement. As a former Republican, I will still say conservative, moderate on some issues, conservative on some others, which is America. She's covered Republicans and Democratic parties for sure. She's written a lot about the threats to Western democracies and sort of exposed a different take on those conversations. She's also a colleague of mine at MSNBC, where she is a contributor and political analyst. And came to the Post after 3 years with Commentary Magazine, and prior to her career in journalism, a lot of people don't know this about Jennifer. She practiced law. She was a labor lawyer for a number of decades. And that experience has really kind of shaped a lot of what she writes about and how she conveys her work in both politics and journalism. She's a mother of two sons and lives with her husband in DC. And what we're going to get in today is the release of her new book, which, folks, is a really, really good read. It's called Resistance: How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. Is out now, and you can get it from all those wonderful places you get your books from. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
It's so nice to be with you, Michael. I was thinking back, we have known each other for a very long time.
Yes,
right? We have. Well before the Trump years.
Oh
well
my gosh, yeah. Yeah, I think even going back before I was at the RNC,
yes.
In various circles in town. That's what I love about Washington is that it really is a small, big town, and people, at least back in the day, actually took time to get to know each other. Today it's not so much the case. Before we get into the new book, and the response to it has been very, very good. We were just talking before we started recording, that Jennifer's like, I actually have to get out and do a lot of talking about this book. It's because people want to know. But before we get into it, what is your assessment of where things are right now between Democrats, among Democrats, because that's where the battle in Washington is right now. Ironically, it's not between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans have largely checked out of any role of governing and trying to be responsible political and legislative actors. So we just discount and set them aside. The real challenge right now in Washington is among Democrats. What's your assessment with the $1.5 trillion offer that's just come out, Manchin and Sinema holding forth the way they are, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer trying to carve together votes. Does this happen on this infrastructure platform, or where do you see things going?
this is really herding cats. I don't envy these people in the least. And sometimes I think to myself, you know, if it was just the House, Nancy Pelosi can accomplish anything.
Yes.
But this is not only within the House, but it's across the House and the Senate. And the White House is basically saying, "Would figure it out, guys. Whatever's in reason that you guys will agree to, we'll do this."
Right.
This is like do or die for this administration. And it's really a huge challenge for Democrats who are always accused of not being able to use power, not being able to govern. And they made a tactical choice early on, which I think I agreed with, which was you're only going to get a couple cuts at the ball here. You're only going to get a couple swings at the ball. So you might as well cram stuff in there. And right. So you only have to go back to Mitch McConnell and those bad Republicans a couple times. As a result, they have these huge bills with all of this stuff crammed into it. And of course, when you do that, the differences within the Democratic Party come out. There are conservative Democrats who don't like really big numbers. That makes them really nervous. Right. And they don't like the really big taxes, at least on corporate America, that need to go with it. And then you get the progressives who really have been starved of any legislative action since the ACA and see that there is actually an appetite. What drives them nuts is that these things are really popular out in the country. Progressives in the past have been trying to talk the American people into a whole list of things. These individual items are very, very popular. The difficulty is many people don't know what's in the bill. Many right. people have only a sense that they're talking some big numbers. People are fighting. So they haven't been able to kind of sell this publicly to generate the kind of pressure on a Manchin or on a Sinema that might help them to get this across the finish line.
That is such an excellent point. And it's one that I scratch my head. And recently I've been traveling. I've been in Florida, Michigan, New York over the last 3 weeks and talking with both Republicans and Democrats on this. And while generally we know there's very little agreement among those two groups about anything, there is agreement among them about one thing, and it's what you just put your finger on. And that's this idea that for some reason, the Democrats have not found the magic narrative to bring the kind of public pressure to bear on the two leading Democrats within their caucus, while there may be others who stand behind them. Sinema and Manchin are the two that everybody knows and are the most public resistors to this effort. Why is that? And does it speak to just how narrow the vote margins are, that both of them know you need me more than I need you?
That is a big part of it. Every one of those 50 men and women is the deciding vote. You give a senator unlimited power, essentially, yeah. for your fate, and watch that person go run wild. I am not surprised that these guys are milking it for all this moment is worth. This is their dream, to have the entire country glued, fixated on what they want to do. I think it's a couple things. I think because they have so much in there that it's hard, for example, if you were going to say this bill is really about expanding vision, dental, and hearing for senior citizens under Medicare, which is in there, that might generate a lot of emphasis. You might mm-hmm. have AARP, you would have all kinds of groups out there clamoring. You could kind of mobilize that. You would have a lot of editorials on the merits. But here, it's not only that, it's the child tax credit. It's a subsidy for childcare. It's paid leave and you know family leave. It's a whole bunch of stuff. So to get any momentum and get any one person or group behind that is extremely difficult. And I come back to the point, I'm not sure there was any other way to do it, because if they went one by one, they would never get through the first one, let alone the last one.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, did they go too big? Yeah. I mean, could they have done all of those items and say, look, we just want a little bit of each one of these, as opposed to a lot of all of these. So that's how you get to, you know, what you saw from the likes of the more progressive members in the House and the Senate, a $5+ trillion deal that they wanted, almost $6 trillion. come back to 3.5, 3.2, and now they're about to get to the sweet spot of 1.5. And I understand that, but I just don't get how they have not figured out that if you don't do this, this is over. I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, you know, politically, but there is truth to the narrative if with the House, this, and because the American public don't give a damn about how close the numbers are. All they know is you have the majority, the House, the Senate, and the White House, and you can't even get any of the president's line items done. Why should we trust you? Now, the flip side of that is, do you really want to go back to these crazy ass Republicans who are out here, you know, trying to rig elections and put bounties on women's bodies, right? And I say that as a pro-life American, because that's exactly what it is. But people who feel the kind of pressure that a lot of Americans are feeling as they're coming out on the other side of COVID, the mixed messaging around COVID, the economy is coming back, but we see some weak spots, there's inflation, there are all these things. They want to see some wins. I think that's what the American people are. So this gets real serious for Democrats like yesterday.
Absolutely. When you tell your constituent groups that you are going to make a fundamental change in the relationship between individuals and government, you're going to try something that hasn't been tried since the New Deal, or at least since LBJ, and you don't deliver, you are by definition a failure. And those people are not going to turn out for you in 2022. There is only so much mileage you get out of running against the crazy ass Republicans. Yes, that's important, but that is not going to be sufficient. These people feel like they were really sold a bill of goods, and now they want some of those goods delivered. And frankly, the American people don't care if it's 3.5 or 1.7 or 2.4.
They don't.
They just want to see that he's gotten a bunch of stuff that's going to make their life easier. We're not giving tax cuts to the rich anymore. We're giving a child tax credit so middle-class people can afford to pay for their kids. Right. And we're getting a bunch of other stuff that seems like it's reasonable and seems like it's going to help my life. If you don't do that, you send the base into a complete depression. And I think the Democratic Party rips itself apart, because what Biden did in the nomination process in the general election is he was able to pull all aspects of that Democratic Party together. He had an ambitious, progressive agenda, but he talked in values, in kind of middle America terms. He wasn't too scary for the more centrist and conservative part of the party, but he certainly had an ambitious part. If they don't deliver on anything, the acrimony, the blame, the sort of fur flying that's going to go on is going to be something frightful. And remember, out there, there's something even more important that they have to do. We haven't even talked about, and that's voting rights. Yeah. If they can't figure this out, are they really going to touch the filibuster and do some fundamental reform to make sure the next election is not a complete circus, and it's not stolen? So this really is do or die. And you and I have the same reaction, which is, you can't possibly blow this. You guys are like driving 60 miles an hour in a car and you're headed to the brick wall. You cannot do this to yourself.
It's so typically Democrats, though. It's just so, I'm like, you guys have, I mean, the last political figure in the Democratic Party who not only understood how to do politics, but did politics exceedingly well, was LBJ.
Probably, yes. Yes. And, you know,
everything else has been emotion. Yeah, everything else has been a bit motion and we feel the economy for the poor and we feel the, I'm like, baby, okay, that's great to have those feelings, but you got to figure out how to do the politics to make those feelings real. You got to bring the American people. You just can't tell the American people to feel something. You got to show them what's in it for them.
Right. And instead, we've gotten into, you know, the noise is so intense in politics now. The Republicans are talking about, dewormer for, a cure for COVID, and are talking about, critical race theory. So just to get an earful to the American people, you have to be so sharp and so persistent. Yeah. And so focused. And it's really, really hard to do. So, my sense with these people is, listen, package number one, that had a coherent message. People get that. They like it. Even Republicans appeared to like it at one point. So they got that. They've got to figure out on the other side how they can focus this and come up with four or five explainable things that have a non-scary number in there. And for God's sakes, can they explain to people this is over 10 years? This is so fundamental.
I know. We're not spending $1 trillion a year, people.
I know. It's not $3.5 trillion a year, guys, but you wouldn't know that because they never say it.
They never say it.
And so everyone thinks $3.5 trillion, how can we spend that? It's over 10 years, guys, but they don't spell that out. So if instead they would sell a $350 billion plan or a $200 billion plan that does these four things, they might be able to stumble through this.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. And that is a perfect backdrop to the important business in front of us. And that is your new book, Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy, from Donald Trump. And in everything we're talking about right now, and I think folks get that how women perceive it, understand it, think about it, move into it, move out of it, is going to matter more than anything else. And in your new book, you talk about how this role for women has developed over time. How women have moved from the backbench of American politics to not just leading in politics, but actually defining what that's going to be. And a lot of that catalyst, yes, comes over the Trump years. But as you note in a piece that you wrote just a few days ago, in the Washington Post, titled How Trump Mobilized Women, Including Me. You said, I quote, "I'd always voted Republican for president, from my first vote for Ronald Reagan to my last for Mitt Romney. I admired mainstream Republicans who were dedicated to victory in the Cold War. I looked to free markets for expanded economic opportunity and embraced free trade and robust legal immigration. If I differed with movement conservatives on some issues, I appreciated their preference for incrementalism and resistance to allowing centralized power to bigfoot, the laboratories of democracy. Given that I actually believed in these things, I watched in horror as Republicans embraced a racist bully bent on undermining our democracy and promoting white Christians' quest for political dominance. I saw social conservatives who demonized Bill Clinton swoon at the feet of a serial liar, adulterer, and racist whose cruelty became a central feature of his presidency. This evidently struck too close to home." And I think for a lot of women who have moved in and out of that political space, where at the end of the day, they found themselves, particularly suburban women, more center left and center right than hard left, hard right. Those 4 years, and certainly what we're seeing now, seems to have crystallized for them the nature of how they want to engage in politics. What was it about? Because I think the title of your book really puts it, resistance. That resistance to extremism, that resistance to the kind of base politics that we've seen take over American political life. What was it that animated for women so concretely that desire to resist?
I think what happened is they were just gobsmacked by that election. It was not simply that they were rooting for a woman to win, Hillary Clinton, and she didn't. It was they couldn't get their heads around the idea that America would embrace someone who was so openly misogynistic, such a bully, such a xenophobe, such a racist, that this was the country that they had thought that they were beginning to make progress in, beginning to scale the heights of power in the public sector, in the private sector. And it really threw them for a loop. It was dumbfounding them. How could someone like that, with that kind of outlook about people like me and that kind of personal venom, cruelty, how could someone like that possibly be in charge of our country? And what does that mean for me? Where am I going to be in this narrative? For particularly for white suburban women, for 40 years or more, they had lived with the understanding that they could get an abortion if they needed to. They had gotten used in the last few decades that they would be treated with some level of respect in public life. That was gone. And so I think it was the sense of horror and disorientation that the country had somehow made a decision or turned out in ways that horrified them. And what happened is, rather than hide under the bed, rather than curl up in a ball, they began to do what women do, which is commiserate, talk, network. And when women do that, they get themselves organized. Anyone who has seen a PTA meeting know how women get things done. Right. Anyone who has seen a woman multitask because she has kids, an office,
right,
philanthropic activities, know these people know how to get stuff done. And what happened is they suddenly made a switch. They were no longer passive observers watching politics and the country roll over them. They were actors. They had power. And they, with their friends, their neighbors, their colleagues, could create something that changed politics. And they themselves could be political actors. There's a great story that Abigail Spanberger, who is now a second-term congresswoman from Virginia, tells, that she was a former CIA official and had left that level of service. And she was trying to get her head around Donald Trump and what had happened. So she goes to a town hall that is undertaken by David Brat, who is the very far right, Trump Tea Party acolyte who bounced Eric Cantor from the House Majority Leader. And she goes in and she's listening to this guy. And she comes out and she says, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And what she was saying is that she finally realized politics, there's no secret sauce here. There's no those politicians and me. You can be a politician. You have the skills. You have the patriotism. You have the skills and the knowledge bank that is not only equal to, but is far superior. And so if you want to change America, you can go out and do it. And
well, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, working in a you know, as a coffee in a coffee shop, making that decision to move into the public space. It's, you know, it's Mikey Sherrill, who, you know, flying jet planes and, I mean, just really high, you know, top secret stuff, coming out of the military and deciding to continue that service in that way. So you have these sort of, not extremes, but these endpoints of where women reside very comfortably, carrying on the business of the day, carrying on with their lives, then making that turn, that pivot into politics. What did you see in your writing resistance that triggered that? What, you know, did the early days, I guess, put it this, what did the early days of this resistance look like and how did it evolve?
It was remarkably organic. And what I mean by that is there was a very similar pattern. As my husband observed, there was always a cake that was uneaten at the election day party. Everyone went out and got a cake and no one ate it because it was a disaster.
Right, right.
And so almost unconsciously, women moved to talk to their friends. And those friends brought in others. And they wanted to figure out, can they do something? And women who were in larger organizations understood they had to focus the energies of their group to figure out how to get through these 4 years. So I think from shock to connectivity to a sense of the possible was kind of the transition. And what the Women's March did was it took, you know, largest day of demonstration in American history. Women suddenly realized, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. Look at all these people. If we can get all these people literally and figuratively marching in the same direction, we've got power. We can do something about this. And immediately after the inauguration and then the Women's March, which was the next day, if you remember, the next week came the Muslim ban. And people spontaneously got in their cars, literally drove out to airports to protest and to be seen. And it was like the kindling was there, the match was lit on the Women's March, and then the bellows come out on the Muslim ban. And suddenly you could see something taking off. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you could see momentum. You could see a sense that people wanted to do something. They were tired of being depressed. They were tired of crying, and they wanted to get out there and do something. And I think the other thing that kind of fueled this is it went well beyond politics. These were issues of basic human decency, of democracy. We're talking children being separated from their parents at the border. We're talking about a Muslim ban. We're talking about kind of these visceral issues that even women who disagreed on other things had a moral and a values-laden response to it. And we talked a little bit ago about how sometimes the Democrats get themselves all tangled up with a zillion policies and, you know, 15-point plans. In politics, if you can get people to move to the next level, one of values, one of what kind of people do we want to be, what kind of country do we want to be, that cuts through a lot of this noise. And there was something about this specter of Trump, and they said, whatever that is, we don't want our country to be that. We want a kinder, more decent, more democratic, fair, more inclusive country. And that covered a lot of bases for a lot.
That begs the question I was going to ask you next, and that is, what exactly are these women, or were these women, resisting? What, you know, this is, you talk about, well, the title is How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump, but in reading it, it's more than that. This is not, I mean, so people just get it straight up. This is not, oh, another anti-Trump book. It's not that at all. It really is about the evolution of a different kind of movement, political energy within the democracy for the purposes of saving that democracy from itself. It's like your mama always did when she comes out on the front porch and calls you to the house and goes, all right, come on in, baby. It's time to come in. And you're like, well, why? Well, what she sees happening on the street, you may not see, but she knows it's time for you to stop doing what you're doing and to come on inside. And, you know, we'll let you play again tomorrow. But right now, I don't like the feel of what's going on in the neighborhood. It's time to come in. Women seem to have taken that role. And it really, it wasn't just about, from my assessment of it, about just 2020 per se. It was 2018. It was 2016. It goes back to 2012, 14. I mean, this has been in the making for a while. And it, for me, the question is, what was the essence of the resistance? Was this the resistance to what men were doing? Is it resistance to the cruelty of the nature of our politics, where, to a point you were making earlier when you're talking about human infrastructure, we don't even want to provide basic aid for moms and kids to survive? What was that resistance?
I think at a very fundamental level, it was the notion that America should be a fair and decent place in which bullies and tyrants don't call the shots, in which there is a level of humanity and decency. And as the neighborhood analogy is so great, we want to live in a nice neighborhood where people are decent to each other, where we're not, you know, kicking the neighbor's dog and we're not throwing stones through the neighbor's house. That there was a vision of America, maybe it wasn't in ideological terms at all, but it was the kind of country that they thought of themselves, the kind of America that they wanted to be. And I think what happened is they really realized that the very foundation, the kind of fabric of who we are as a country, was being severely tested, was being torn apart. There was another idea out there that America was kind of a dog-eat-dog world. Right. It was a zero-sum place. You needed a strong man to save this group of people and
right.
up against that group of people. That's
and he was actually the problem.
Yes, that was not what they wanted. And so I think it was a rediscovery that the way you get to that better, decent place, you really have to go back to fundamentals. Do we have a democracy? Do we have a free press? Do we have transparency? Are we going to allow people to use office purely for self-promotion mm-hmm. and financial gain? That in order to create the good life and the good America, you have to have certain democratic norms, certain modes of behavior, and these people were trampling all over it. And that was an anathema to them. So I think more than any policy issue, it was about taking back a country where no matter who was president, you felt that there was a president, maybe you didn't vote for him, maybe you didn't like his policies, who was for America, who wanted what's best for the country, who was not out to scam America, who would stand up to its adversaries, who, if given the choice between helping people live through a pandemic and not living through a pandemic, would do the right thing. And suddenly they didn't have that. It was like they had been almost overtaken by a foreign power, a foreign ethos that was very antithetical to what they had. And I think they understood that in order to, if I want to get more in healthcare or you want to get, you know, a better foreign policy, whatever those little, and I don't want to demean them, whatever those discrete issues are, if you don't get the ethos right, if you don't get the structure of democracy right, we are not going to be able to function as a society. And it's not simply we're not going to be able to get what we want. It's what we have is going to be lost, that we are going to turn into a society where violence and racism and a lot of other bad things really have a strength in our society that they've not had in a while. And so I think it was a very emotional, very value-laden exercise. And in some ways, the Democrats, either intentionally or not, were very smart in finding a Joe Biden who a lot of these women could say, the soul of America, that's what he kept saying. It was more than he's a decent person. We can be a decent country. We can respect one another. We can respect democracy. We can have a president who follows the rules, who has some conception that the Constitution doesn't allow him to do whatever the heck he wants and get rich and get his kids rich and everybody else, that we can have something other than a tin pot dictator. So in some ways, for once, the Democrats really like nailed it on the kind of figure and the kind of message that could not only bring Democrats together, but could bring people like you and I together, independents who could say, we just have to get back to some fundamental understandings about what America is going to be like. And, you know, these things happen incrementally. They build on one another. You have in 2017, Trump takes office, you have the Muslim ban, they turn out. Trump's big push was to repeal Obamacare with really nothing that was going to take its place. And suddenly the country said, you know, it has a lot of problems, but this is not a good idea, taking healthcare away from people. And even Republicans began to realize that. Yeah. It's like, I don't want you taking away the Affordable Care Act, but Obamacare can go.
Right. always an amusing conversation.
Yes. Once they realized that this was them. And so suddenly they realized they had power. Oh, these guys do not have, the sole lock on things. You then come around into the fall and you have those Virginia state elections where a slew of women run and they essentially sweep the state houses, 15 seats, switch sides in Virginia. So this is about the momentum. You then have in Alabama, Roy Moore, accused child molester in Alabama. And they pull off this stunning upset that is built by, again, a values-laden argument, a revulsion that this is not the kind of people we want in politics. And politics is about a lot of things, and one of them is momentum, the sense of confidence, the sense of progress that the country had made a really bad choice, but we're not destined to go down that road. We have a choice. And so when success breeds success, and once women get into positions, they're there to kind of pull up other women. And I really do think that at least in the congressional realm, these women who ran and won office for the first time in 2018 were blessed because they had Nancy Pelosi as a speaker. And what she did was she took freshmen, gave them subcommittee chairman, which to your voters sounds like, oh, well, big deal. That's a huge deal.
It's a big deal.
Freshmen women don't get these things, right off the bat. But she understood you got to put these women on the escalator to leadership. You got to put them in positions where they can show that they're, tough, muscular on national security. They can lead a committee. And sure enough, she was able to kind of put these people on the escalator. And you have Deb Haaland, who is now the Secretary of Interior. She was a freshman.
Right.
And, she would not have gotten there. She would not have been in the majority. She would not have gotten recognition had it not been for Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
And so I think once you have these success stories, people see something's possible. Okay, we made a difference. Wow. We had a success here and we can build on that. And in some regards, they were extremely lucky because they had this hateful figure in the White House who continually reminded them they had more in common than they did. Child separation policy, promising and then, refusing to do anything on a parkland, which was a huge issue in after the midterms, where, kids, high school kids getting mowed down in schools. There was such a gap between ordinary people's sense of values and decency and what they saw that they could put aside some of these ideological issues and focus on the kind of country they wanted to have. And I think women, you talked earlier, and I think that's exactly right. They began to change the way we talk about politics. Republicans have always talked about values. You can say that they're phony values or they're bad values. And Democrats have talked about policy. For the first time across the board, and particularly Democrats who are in the resistance, understood the power of values, the power of emotion, the power of a higher vision of what they want for the country. And we'd like to think, because we're all wonky and we know 7-point plans for this and 12-point plans for that, that people make choices because they like this healthcare plan or they like that education plan. No, that's not how they pick their leaders. They pick people who they think represent their basic values, are going to be in there getting stuff that is going to make their lives better and making the country a decent, better place.
Right.
And it was that understanding that allowed a relatively large ideological group to get together and essentially eliminate the Republicans from power in 2020, losing the Senate, losing the White House.
It goes to the heart of what I want to get into next, which is the pitch. The book is Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. The author is my friend, Jennifer Rubin, of the Washington Post. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the pitch made all the difference in the world. We'll be right back.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. We're having a great conversation, getting a little bit of the inside narratives that helped shape a movement that really began in January of 2016, at least manifested itself in January of 2017, rather, on the heels of the inauguration of President Trump, when over a million women converged on the nation's capital to begin to stake their claim in the nation's politics more directly. Jennifer has written a great book that not only touches on that, but a whole lot of other parts of this movement. It's entitled Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. And in the book, Jennifer, in chapter 19, you talk about the pitch to women. And it really speaks to what the Democrats figured out and got right. And as they were looking to put together the strategies, recognizing the growing concern, as you've expressed, that women had about what was happening in the neighborhood, to stay with that theme of you know, watching neighbor turn on neighbor and just general decay in the body politic. You talk about the convention at one point. You say the convention, quote, the convention emphasized moderation, not revolution, competence, not ideological purity. The formula was simple. Remind women alienated from the GOP of Trump's obnoxious know-nothingism that turned them off from the GOP in 2018. Hit Trump for failing to confront the COVID-19 pandemic that killed 170,000 Americans by August. Offer the Biden-Harris ticket as an island of stability, competency, and decency, end quote. And that was a key part of the formulation for a lot of women. Okay, I see that, all right, Trumpism and all of that. I've just gone through that, and I'm like, oh, hell no. But I'm looking over here, what you got for me? What can you show me? And this idea that this ticket, this president and vice president would be the grownups, would bring about that stability that was the direct response to the chaos of the last 4 years, that would show competency. And I would say that's what one of the big things, particularly competency with respect to COVID, really for a lot of those moms out there who had sick husbands and parents and relatives, that mattered a lot. And just decency, how you talk to each other and how I don't like your politics, but I like you, you know, you're okay. All of that mattered seemingly for a lot of women.
It absolutely did. And that convention was fascinating to me. It was really of, by, and for women. You remember that they had to do a virtual convention.
Right.
Everybody thought no one would watch, and what everyone wound up watching because they had run out of Netflix things to watch.
Right. So, we've gone through enough Lion King to.
Yes, exactly. So, okay, fine. We'll sit in front of the screen. We'll watch anything. We'll watch these people. Women were represented, old women, young women, an elevator operator who embraced Biden as he's going up to the New York Times to try to get their endorsement, ordinary women, women who had lost relatives during COVID. So women saw themselves, finally, after this guy being so cruel, so demeaning, so hateful towards women, they were there. They could see themselves. And beyond that, they could see people talking, not screaming at them as they were in the Republican convention, not this sort of fascistic bombast, but a conversational, empathetic tone in which they were treated like grownups. And Biden had a large number of women on this campaign He had Stephanie Cutter, who ran this campaign, created this phenomenal presentation. They knew that women were their focus. And everything, I think, was designed around that. They want to speak to women. They want women to be seen. They want to talk in a language and a vocabulary that women can relate to. And they want to tell women that their concerns, childcare, education, healthcare, are the things that matter to them, not creating some bogeyman about who's at the border, who's coming to invade us, not a whole bunch of other stuff that Trump was talking about, but stuff that was going to take care of them and their family as they were sitting there in this horrendous COVID infested world, that here are some people who are going to come along, be decent, help you get back to where you needed to be. And that whole thing was, I think, going to become a sort of a lesson plan for how you talk to women voters and how you attract them. And that's not to say they didn't want men. They didn't want male voters. Of course right. they did. But they really knew who their prime audience was. And sure enough, it was the largest gender gap in history that Biden wound up winning.
Do women, or in your research and conversations for the book, did you find that women drew a distinction between likability and electability? Because I remember how that became sort of a sub-narrative in the campaign. And at least a number of folks on the Republican side were kind of, you know, trying to play Joe Biden off as, yeah, people like him, but he's not electable. You know, he's just, I mean, because he's too much of a, you know, left-leaning, you know, puppet of, you know, the squad, et cetera. How do women break it down? How do women break down? And you're obviously not going to speak for all women, but in your work on this book, how did you find women breaking down those elements of politics that, you know, political professionals kind of look at and use to help move their candidates through the course of an election?
Women have a huge challenge, and you really saw this come out in the presidential election. Stacey Abrams had a great way of putting this. She said, a guy wakes up.
Oh, is this the same Stacey Abrams yes. that Donald Trump just endorsed?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear, but we're talking about the same
yes.
former Speaker of the Georgia House Democrat. Right. Okay, yeah, gotcha. Exactly. I didn't mean to cut you off, but go ahead.
Not at all. So she says, a man rolls out of bed one day, has a great hair day, and says, I'm going to run for office. People assume that he has some competence, he has confidence. A woman has to explain why she went into politics, what she's doing there, has to come with a resume that's like a mile long.
And why is she abandoning her family?
Family, exactly. And does she have a family? And they have to come up with an origin story, how it was that you decided to go into politics. So Amy Klobuchar tells the story of going into the hospital and getting thrown out after 24 hours. Her daughter, who has some healthcare problems, has to remain in the hospital. And that's how she got into healthcare. So that was her origin story. Did any of these men who had never held off, did Yang have to have an origin story?
Right.
Who was he? What had he done? He didn't need any experience. He didn't need any competence. He barely needed any ideas. He would just get out there.
Just and need to be it. A male.
Exactly. So women are confronted with this duality. They're expected to be super competent, super strong, have a grasp of national security, but they got to be likable. They got to be, you know, the old, got to have a beer with them. And right. the problem is women don't have some of these tropes that men have. Men go duck hunting, you know, that's right. like a regular guy kind of thing. What's a woman going to do? She's not going to go duck hunting unless she's a duck hunter. Right. You know, they have to come up with a language, a vocabulary that has them become approachable, real, without showing weakness.
Yeah, because you can't reinforce, for example, she can't get out there and reinforce that caring, nurturing side of herself, because then that just reinforces the stereotype negative that people have. Well, why, you know, if you're that caring, then why are you coming into politics? You should be caring for your family and your kids and your church. And so I see that, duality for women. And how do they then decide to overcome it? Do they just go, you know, to hell with it? I'm going to make my case. Because when I look around the globe, this does not seem to be an issue for women around the globe, given the number of women who are currently serving as prime ministers, presidents, and leaders of their nation, one of whom just stepped down, Angela Merkel, who is arguably the preeminent leader, male or female, of the 21st century so far. Doesn't have to, you know, talk about, you know, her, you know, her origin story to become the prime minister, the chancellor of Germany. But what is it? What do women find themselves doing? Right. Do they just push through it?
They do. And they have to find their own comfort zone. They have to find their own living in your own skin, talking in a language, you know, vocabulary that they feel comfortable with. You know, Beto O'Rourke was going to jump on a bunch of, you know, counters and, yes, you know, do a pretty boy layout for Vanity Fair. No woman was going to do that. So you have to find ways to relate. Now, sometimes it's a very subliminal message. Elizabeth Warren stayed out there in Washington Square Park in New York City for 4 hours taking selfies with every person in line.
I remember that, yeah.
Okay. Yes, she's getting information on them. Yes, it's a good way of connecting. She's also communicating strength, determination, stamina, mm-hmm, all of these things. If you remember Donald Trump, you know,
that no man would do.
Yeah.
No man would stand there for 4 hours taking selfies or talking to anybody.
Exactly.
And they just wouldn't do it in politics because they,
exactly,
they wouldn't feel they had to.
And if you remember what Donald Trump did to Hillary Clinton, she was practically at death's door, according to Donald Trump. Remember, she had the flu, she was dying, yes, she had a brain tumor, you know, all, yes, of these, you know, things, because the idea is weak, woman is weak. So you do things which show endurance, you do things which show toughness, but you also have to develop a comfort style in talking to people and relating to people. And I will say that during her presidential race, which was not a huge success, but ultimately she was chosen as vice president, Kamala Harris has an extraordinary ability. The only person that I can analogize to is Bill Clinton. When you are talking to her, you are the only person in that room. She knows you. She remembers who you are. She makes you feel like you matter. You are seen by her. Mm-hmm. And that ability to empathetically relate to voters is something that women have, and it is something that they can use. And she made an extraordinary impact, even though she didn't get very far, on young women, on girls, and the sort of devotion that she inspired from her staff and from what became the K-Hive, if you remember, this online group, was extraordinary. So women have different skills, different talents, and they have to kind of find their way. I also think, frankly, success breeds success. It was easier to be a woman, one of four senators, than it was to be the only woman, Hillary Clinton. For example, I'll give you a good analogy. Hillary Clinton, how many columns, how much chatter did we have to sit through about her hair and her clothes? That didn't happen because there are too many women to talk about everybody's clothes. And oh, by the way, there were like 24 candidates. So the papers and the cable could,
although I did read a few articles about the fact that these women never wore dresses.
Yes, exactly. There you go.
Which I thought was fascinating, that was the go-to for the American media.
Right. And there's
women running for the most powerful office in the world, you're fixated on the fact that they wear pantsuits and not dresses.
Right. But yeah.
Exactly. I digress.
Exactly. So it gets better. It gets better in small doses. And I end the book with the inauguration and right. simply visual imagery of Kamala Harris. Suddenly, you know, the president and vice president who walk up to the tomb of the unknown soldier are not two gray guys in dark suits. There she is, just splendid in bright colors, commanding her space, elegant, forceful, a presence. She shapes the way people then think of who is a leader. I'm sure your kids have and other people's kids have had those, you know, posters that you put up in the kids' room that has every president of the United States. Right. And you, white guy, white guy, white guy. And then at the very bottom in one corner is Barack Obama. You finally get to a black guy. None of them are women. So the mental image that people have of president, of what a powerful person looks like, that changes when you get people who break through. It's going to be easier whether Kamala Harris runs for president or some other woman runs for power.
What is it?
People get acclimatized to at least seeing a woman in that position.
Is it?
Now she's also gotten a lot of flack for being there.
No, she has. And let's set Kamala aside because I think a lot of that's kind of made up drivel and some of it, there's some substance to it. And that's a conversation. But I do agree with your point that at some point, my question is, what is that point? We're 245 years coming on now into this great experiment. As you just said, you look at the poster of all our presidents. Okay, there's little Barack down in the corner. All men. Okay, got that. But you talk about, and you reference in your book, and I remember the article in The Atlantic. Hillary Clinton's candidacy has provoked a wave of misogyny, one that may roil American life for years to come. My point on that is her candidacy didn't provoke a wave of misogyny. Her candidacy exposed the right. misogyny. It exposed the paternalism. It exposed the puritanical attitudes we still have in the 21st century about women in power. You can be my county executive. You can be my state rep. Okay, I could make you a U.S. senator. We'll think about governor, because just look at the number of women governors we have out of 50. But president, I'll get back to you.
Yeah.
And there's a lot behind that. I have my political differences with Hillary Clinton, but at the end of the day, she would have been a damn sight better than Donald Trump. Okay. I mean, when you just put it all together, right? We probably have this. Now we have big battles over policy. That's a very different conversation. But what does it say that the country would prefer the clown show over the competent woman who was the Secretary of State, the First Lady of the country, the United States Senator?
Now you're getting to the origin of the book, which is this shock.
And that's what I wanted to go. So go for it.
How could you elect this clown? It's not enough that, you know, the A students hire the C students hire the A students. This was the F student who didn't know anything about anything and was so manifestly unqualified. She'd done everything right. She'd study. She knew her policy. She had worked her way up. She knew foreign policy.
And Republicans liked working with her in the Senate, yes. By the way, people. I know that firsthand because I worked with those Republicans when I was in national politics. So it's not like, I mean, the narrative on Hillary Clinton is a dual narrative. One is the political one where we just want to throw stones at her because, hey, that just gins up a base. And the other is the one that those members of the Senate who worked with her said, hey, yeah, she knows her stuff. Right. And we could get some things done with Senator Clinton. But go ahead.
And it was that outrage that it wasn't just that Trump won, but that a misogynist of that level of stupidity and vulgarity won, over a woman who had done everything right. And how many women out there have done everything right?
Right.
They were conscientious. They went to school. They studied for the test. They took care of their family and the work, and they still don't get the big job.
Right.
So women could identify with this sense that there was an irrationality and a sense of almost futility. What do we have to do?
Why didn't they vote for the numbers that they saw that they voted for Joe Biden?
Or
Donald Trump, for that matter.
It is a great question. And you have to kind of, and this is another part of the book, you have to really kind of get down to which women are we talking about. Democrats have, whether it's Joe Biden, whether it's Hillary Clinton, whether it's Kamala Harris, have still not cracked the secret formula on white, non-college educated Southern women. They are marinating in the same right-wing goop that their male counterparts are. Religion cuts across this. Geography cuts across this. Religion cuts across this. However, look at a slightly different cross-section of women. College-educated white women. They used to be a big part of the Republican Party when you and I were Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, the women's clubs, how important are they in the kind of structure of county politics, state politics? The people who worked the polls, the people who did, you know, the door knocking, women, women, women. And those people have abandoned the Republican Party in droves because they are the people who have been really kind of so turned off by this toxic Republican Party. And the question as to why Biden did better than Hillary Clinton among some of these women's groups is a complicated question. On one hand, you can say, well, people actually saw what Donald Trump was, and they didn't have that. They didn't have the experience of having lived under him.
Right.
So having seen him up close, that really magnified it. But I think we also have to come to terms with the fact that there are women. I mean, you don't have to look any farther than Marjorie Taylor Greene to see that there was a whole ilk of very conservative white women who resent other women and who are going to embrace for whatever, you know, ideological, cultural, racial reasons, the white guy bully instead of the woman. And that is a facet of American politics as well. And I think in a lot of ways, what women figured out in this whole period of time was that women have power if they hang together. Women have power if they help each other. Women have power if they can connect and create their own money organizations, their own political organizations, and that in a critical mass, whether it's Congress or whether it's in a party, they have a lot of power. And what I hope going forward and what I hope people get out of this book is you got to keep doing it. I realize people are exhausted. Oh my God. You know, 4 years of Donald
I keep, Trump. I'm telling them now, babe, we're just warming up. 2020 was the warm up.
Yes, exactly.
You ain't got time to be tired.
And you say, what do you mean? I had to put up with 4 years of Donald Trump, then COVID. I had to homeschool my kid. Can I get a break? And the answer is no, you don't get a break because the big message of this book is democracy is a participatory sport. No one else is going to do it. This is you. And what we should take away from these women, phenomenal women who I have such admiration for, is they did it. They said, no one else is going to do it. We better get in the game. We better do it. Our country is important enough for us. And particularly mothers in huge numbers said, I'm going to have to explain to my daughters and my sons, what did I do when my country was at this point? How am I going to explain to them what I did to make America a decent place? And I think that spirit of both optimism, commitment, and obligation is what we have to kind of conserve. You can't have a free ride in democracy. You don't just get to sit back and, you know, doom scroll through your Twitter feed and complain. In some fashion, whether you run for office, whether you volunteer on a campaign, whether you write letters, whether you protest, however you're going to engage in politics, you have to engage. And if you don't, the crazies are going to run away with the country. And I think that was the positive message I got. It sustained me during the Trump years. I gotta say, these women were like a life, an emotional lifeline for me. And well, I hope they are for readers too.
You have been engaging ever since I've first known you. You've done it again with this book, Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. I highly recommend it to those who listen to my podcast. I think you will enjoy it. I think you will get some fresh insights into the probably the most important political force to galvanize in this country in two or three generations, to be honest. And this is beyond the civil rights movement. This is beyond anything that we've seen, because as we saw in January of 2017, when women decide they've had enough, to put it in the vernacular, shit changes. It just does. It just does. And we've seen that over the last few years. And I'm glad you took the time to sort of do that deep dive, Jennifer, with your new book. And I wish you every success with it.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, Michael. It always feels like, you know, old home week when we get back together again. Back in the neighborhood. Yes. So keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Jennifer is just it's a great read for sure. You can also catch her in her writings for the Washington Post as an opinion writer for them. And certainly her other writings on politics and policy. Jennifer, where can we find you on Twitter?
On Twitter, it is J. Rubin Blogger. How's that? I go so far back. I started as a blogger.
As a blogger.
Yes. So back in the day. J. Rubin Blogger. Or if you just put in Jennifer Rubin, you'll probably get the right one. There's an actress, Jennifer Rubin. That's not me.
Right.
I'm the other one. I'm the journalist. So
it's Rubin, folks. R-U-B-I-N.
Thank you. Yes.
So J. Rubin Blogger on Twitter. And check out the new book, Resistance, How Women Saved Democracy from Donald Trump. That does it for this part of the conversation, folks. You know, it's always a joy when you step into the neighborhood. I really appreciate it. Take care of yourselves. Be safe out there. Get the vaccine. Yep. Wear the mask. Okay. Just do what's right. All right. Just do the right thing so you can be around for Christmas and New Year's and all the good stuff to come. All right. Until next time, be safe, be well. I'm out.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.